Good morning on this Shabbat, February 10th, 2018. And Shalom. So you can come in and find a seat. And we'll just start with some prayer. Lord, thank you for your Shabbat. Thank you for bringing us here. I pray you'd inspire our discussion, be with us, and give us more insights into the passages we're reading and also how it relates to our relationship with you. And bless all who are coming this morning. Send your spirit to speak to people, touch them where they need to be touched. And if any who are sick, I pray you would heal them. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Unfortunately, Gary's not with us this morning because he's taking care of our sick kid, Tzemach. Yeah, and it's a shame because we are looking at Leviticus 25, which is the year of Jubilee. This is something that Gary looked at in his thesis, so instead you're getting me. I mean, I was on schedule to do it anyway, but it's more his baby than mine. So our references today, you can't probably read them back there. They are Leviticus 25, verses 14 through 34. And then with that, since we're following this triennial parasha, we get Isaiah 24, verses 2 to 11, and Isaiah 52, verse 3 and following, so we can decide to what point. And so we're going to look at these texts, and we're going to look at the connecting words and themes, because they kind of highlight, they bring out certain meanings in the text. Just like when you're cooking, if you pair certain foods together, it brings out certain flavors. And, you know, if you have pear and wine, it'll taste different than if you have pear and cheese. So we're going to see this particular recipe today. So if we can start in Leviticus 25, verse 14, we will start, Gemma can start us off reading, and then whoever can read some verses in English will just go around in a circle. If you prefer not to read, just point to the person next to you and they will read.
I think it's correct. You should start with 13 and make more sense.
It does make more sense, but that's the interesting thing, that we're in 14. Yeah.
So you don't want it in context.
Okay. Well, no, you can go ahead and start in 13, but then notice verse 14, because those are some of our connecting words are going to be in 14.
In this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his possession. And if you sell anything to your neighbor or buy from your neighbor's hand, you shall not oppress one another. According to the number of years after the Jubilee, you shall buy from your neighbor, and according to the number of years of crops, he shall sell to you. According to the multitude of years, you shall increase its price, and according to the fewer number of years, you shall diminish its price. For he sells to you according to the number of the years of the crops. Therefore you shall not oppress one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God.
Therefore you shall do my statutes and keep my ordinances and perform them, so that you will dwell in the land securely. And I will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and dwell in it securely. And if you say, what shall we eat in the seventh year, if we may not sow or gather in our crop? If you ask, I will command my blessing upon you in the sixth year, so that it will bring forth fruit for 3 years. When you sow in the eighth year, you shall be eating old produce until the ninth year. When the produce comes in, you shall not eat the old. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine, for you are strangers and sojourners with me, and in all the country you possess you shall grant a redemption of the land.
Nick, do you have English there?
Hebrew.
Okay. Ram, do you have English? Hebrew.
Hebrew.
Okay, Zach, go ahead.
If your brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, then his nearest redeemer shall come and redeem what his brother has sold. If a man has no one to redeem it, and then himself becomes prosperous and finds sufficient means to redeem it, let him calculate the years since he sold it, pay back the balance to the man to whom he sold it, and then return to his property. But if he does not have sufficient means to recover it, then what he stole shall remain in the hand of the buyer until the year of Jubilee. And in Jubilee it shall be released, and he shall return to his property.
Okay.
If a man sells a house in a walled city, he retains the right of redemption a full year after its sale. During that time, he may redeem it. If it is not redeemed before a full year has passed, the house in the walled city shall belong permanently to the buyer and his descendants. It is not to be returned in the Jubilee, but houses and villages without walls around them are to be considered as open country. They can be redeemed, and they are to be returned in the Jubilee.
The Levites also have the right to redeem their houses in the Levitical towns which they possess. So the property of the Levites is redeemable, that is, a house sold in any town they hold, and is to be returned in the Jubilee, because the houses in the towns of the Levites are their property among the Israelites. But the pasture land belonging to their towns must not be sold, it's their permanent possession.
If any of your fellow Israelites become poor and are unable to support themselves among you, help them as you would a foreigner and stranger, so they can continue to live among you.
That's it. Interesting also, we started kind of a verse off of the selection, and we end, there's a stuma. We end after, like, the beginning of a new paragraph, basically, is how we end. So an interesting little parasha selection here.
So you say you're ending what I call, what your mother's just read, is 35.
I see. You're right. I just gave the wrong reference.
Okay.
Okay, so then that's not so curious. That kind of solves it for us. Just to the end of 34.
You think it does stop at 34?
Yes.
Right.
I think it does.
Okay.
I just misread my own writing. Yep, there it says 34.
No, it's okay.
Thank you. So we end with the field property of the city will not be sold for the Levite because it's a achuzat olam. It's a perpetual possession. So you remember when all the tribes were given their possessions, the Levites didn't have a possession?
Right.
Because they're the Lord's, and so basically they live off of all the other tribes. All the tithes go to the Levites. That's what they're living off of. So they don't need their own land. They're dependent on God and the system He set up. And that's why their houses.
These first landowners, if they filled the land immediately, and then they got their claim, but that can't be the way. They just kind of moved in, and the first Jewish owner was the owner.
Basically. I mean, it's all about the possession of the land. Like, you have a possession. Each tribe has a delineated area. And then within that, your ancestors would fill out and possess it. And then based on those original possessions, it would continue from generation to generation. And it's interesting in this selection. Someone help me out here. What is the concept of the Jubilee? What is that about? What does it mean to you?
To me, it means the land returns to its rightful owner.
When?
Original owner.
In the 50th year.
Okay? So it means that when you sell your land, you're really just renting it out. As this selection tells you, you're selling the land so that the person buying it is really buying rights to the produce in that land. They're not permanently buying the land.
Right.
And so after 50 years, no matter what, that land is going to go back to the original owner.
Is it like taboo here? I'm not very good on house law here. But I bought my house 30 years ago. But as I understand it, according to Tabu, at the end of 99 years...
Now, the modern laws probably derive some basis.
They must do.
However, we're not going to get into them because they are a little different. The laws here, if you were living in Jerusalem when it was a walled city, you would follow the laws for the walled city, in which case your house can be sold forever. If you have a house in a city, it's not considered land. You can sell it forever, and the person who buys it, that's their house. And then they would hand it down to their descendants. If you have a villa, so it's outside the city wall, then it's considered part of the land. And then it's under the land laws that every 50 years it would be returned to its original owner. So in that case, you have to calculate the price based on how close you are to the Jubilee. So if you're 10 years away, the price for your field is going to be less than if you're 49 years away, right? Because you're paying, it actually delineates that here, you're paying for the amount of harvest you're going to get from the land. So there's this concept of Jubilee that's obviously very big.
And are there any records that they did it?
That's a good question.
I'm sure there are. I just don't know where they are.
Because, you know, we were talking about the stoning and the other things. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
If it's an attitude more than a law.
I think so, depending how far back of a record you want. Like,
so
I don't... Yeah, I don't think we would have records like in David's day, but in...
I don't think in the Bible, where in the Bible does it mention property in the Jubilee? There's kind of a hint here and there, like the Book of Ruth has a hint that they were doing something along those lines.
So this is the related thing to Jubilee. If you notice in our passage, first we're emphasizing the land and returning the land. But then we also brought up the word goel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I'm writing a gimel aleph lamed. Goel, ga'al. And this is a redeemer or a kinsman redeemer. So this is something that we don't have in Western modern cultures, but many cultures do have it, where it's basically someone from your family who will fight for justice.
You wrote for you.
I tried. It's so, Kinen Aleph Lamed. So, a Goel Dam, for instance, if somebody murders someone, a close family member or the closest kin would then go and find the person who murdered him and kill him. And that was considered just recompense. Now, if that person did it by accident, they can flee to the city of refuge and stay there till high priest dies and have, you know, it's like a timeout or touching the base so you can't get tagged. But so this concept of kinsman redeemer is a family member who's going to go and fight back for you. And in this case, well, there are two things a kinsman redeemer can do. One is economic, where you can buy back someone else's land. If you have a relative who's too poor and had to sell their land, you can buy it back for them. Or if you have someone murdered in your family, you can go get blood vengeance for them. And it's an interesting concept because who is Israel's Goel?
Yeshua.
Okay, well, in biblical text, God himself is Israel's Goel.
So I want to just redeeming that one, is it in the year of Jubilee or is it any time? I didn't quite understand.
I guess it depends which part you're talking about. If it's someone who's killed a relative, it's any time. If it's land, it would be the year of Jubilee. I mean, we have record. You remember the story in Ruth. What happens in Ruth, chapter 4?
What to do with
Boaz?
Boaz?
The other guy. And
If you want to look,
redeem her.
If you want to look at Ruth chapter 4.
We have to make a deal with the guy who mm-hmm. has the first right, and they do a legal thing with the shoe, and then he can redeem her mm-hmm. and her land.
Okay, so in Ruth 4, is the word we're looking at is Hagoel. Some people translate kinsman redeemer. The NET Bible has guardian. And so they come to the city gate to make a deal. This guardian comes along, and Boaz talks to him. Very interesting. I have to read you this NET Bible translation. Boaz said, "Come here and sit down, John Doe." So he came and sat down. I kid you not, that's what my translation has.
What verse is that? John Doe in the best Hebrew.
In verse 1. It's a nice, it's an idiomatic nice translation of Ploni Almoni. Ploni Almoni is what you say when it's anonymous. So-and-so.
So-and-so.
They're purposefully leaving the name out because... I'm assuming because they don't want to bring shame on this person for generations because he turned down marrying Ruth, right? And Ruth becomes this historical heroine. And so they're keeping him anonymous. So he came and sat down. Boaz chose 10 of the village elders and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. Then Boaz said to the guardian, "Naomi, who has returned from the region of Moab, is selling the portion of land that belongs to our relative Elimelech." So, you remember Elimelech was Naomi's husband? Mm-hmm. And they left the land because of famine. Mm-hmm. So the question is, when did she actually make this sale of the land? It's not entirely clear. But somehow she's ended up in Moab, and of course she's a widow. So she's in one of those economic categories of poverty, basically. You need to help her out because all her male descendants, her husband and her two sons, have died. And so she would be one of these poor people that the relatives have to goel, have to save or redeem. Now, so I am legally informing you, acquire it before those sitting here and before the leaders of my people. So far Boaz is saying, you know, buy back her land, essentially. If you want to exercise your right to redeem it, then do so. But if not, then tell me so I will know. For you possess the first option to redeem it. I am next in line after you. And then he replied, "I will redeem it." And we're like, oh no.
But so what do you think of the idea that they sold their land
before they left?
In order to have money to go move to Moab, they sold their land, took off, then everybody dies, so she comes back, and they're asking for someone to buy back the land from whoever Elimelech sold it to.
Right. Yeah, that's what I
mean. Yeah. I think that makes perfect sense, because it does have Machra Naomi. So... is the machra there that she had sold, or is it saying that she hereby sells?
That's the question.
And it seems more that it makes more sense that she had sold.
Right.
How else would the goel buy it back?
Right. And how else would it be considered redemption if she had not sold it?
Or why would she wouldn't have sold it when she came back?
No.
I mean,
it's history. Exactly. Exactly.
It's history. However. But the thing which I was muddled with is this thing about taking off the shoe. John Doe takes off the shoe,
right,
to reject this offer, basically.
And that would kind of be a whole other Bible study in itself, so we're not going to go there. But it is interesting, the law about levirate marriages, when your husband dies, the brother is supposed to marry you. That gets mixed in here to the redemption of the land, right? They're combining the marriage with the field, and it's really the levirate marriage that has the shoe thing, although it's reversed from what we see in Ruth.
Right.
So it's an interesting... It seems like Ruth is kind of spinning that law or somehow interpreting it. But in both cases, in Ruth and the law, you have taking off of a sandal as some type of legal witness before people. And it seems to be a shameful thing. I mean, this part of the world, the bottom of your shoe is yuck. You know, yeah. It's full of dust and it's associated with some shame.
And it's not, yeah. There's the famous thing when the past president, I will not name him, put his feet up on the table in front of Bibi. And in Muslim countries, when there's a riot in parliament or whatever, there's all sorts of stories of them picking up shoes and throwing them at the speaker. And
yeah, well, we're not going to go there. But
no, but it is interesting. That
okay, let it be interesting. When, so Boaz continues, okay, so you want to redeem the field, fine. When you redeem the field, you also have to marry Ruth the Moabite in order to preserve his family name. And so then, and of course, Naomi would come with Ruth because she's a dependent. She's a mother-in-law. So then the girl says, hey, then I can't do it because I'd ruin my own inheritance. Basically, I don't have enough money to take care of two more people. And so, you go ahead.
So what does verse 9 say in the original?
Verse 9?
Yes.
So Boaz said to the elders and to all the people, you are witnesses that I have bought all that was to Elimelech and all that was to Chilion and Mahalon from the hand of Naomi. And Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Mahalon, I've bought for me as a wife.
So does that sound like they bought it from Naomi at this time rather than that she had sold it to somebody else?
It does, and that's the confusing factor, I think.
Because I know the NIV translates
it.
It still belonged to Naomi in the previous person's also.
Yeah. Well, if you look at it from the telescoped perspective, what we're saying in Leviticus is if it's your land, it's essentially always your land. So if you had to sell it temporarily, it's like you're renting it out. Mm-hmm. Someone could still refer to it as your land because it is originally your land. So maybe in that sense they're saying you're buying it from Naomi, even though it's not really from Naomi. I don't know. It's a difficult preposition there to fit into the picture because it doesn't make so much sense. It would have been easier to understand if it said for Naomi. And of course,
why this other guy wouldn't have been involved. I mean, if he was buying the land from Naomi.
Right. Yeah. If Naomi had her land, why would she need someone to redeem it? It wouldn't really make sense.
But this, we're looking at Ruth. Just as
an example
really, Sheila's
of
question
living
about
out the law of
Jubilee redemption. The whole bank shoot, right.
And in here, there's no mention of Jubilee, of course.
No.
And we don't know at what year we're talking about. But theoretically, the price would have been negotiated based on how close you were to the Jubilee. So if it were 25 years out, it would be a certain price. If it's only 10 years out, another price. So the year before, you know, you're going to get a great deal. But then you're going to have to give it back next year.
I think, let me summarize, I think I heard you say that to buy it from Naomi meant that Naomi has the right of possession. So
yeah.
You're buying the right of use from whoever actually has the right of use. You're paying them.
Mm-hmm.
But you're getting the right of use from Naomi because she...
It's her land. Yeah. That's what I'm saying, even though it comes across as confusing, as if you're handing Naomi the money for the land.
Right, and as if she was in control of the land.
Right.
And
but that wouldn't make sense with the whole story or the reason for needing to redeem that land.
And like so many things, when we say them in a short way, if you understand the full culture behind it, you sort all of that stuff out automatically because, well, duh, that's of course what it means. That's what she meant when she said that. But to the outsider, it's like, wow, that's a complicated way to
So, back to this Jubilee concept, if you look at Leviticus 25 in the beginning, you see, the assumption is that you kind of know these laws for the Jubilee, but it's important to God. In verse 14 he says, so that no one wrongs his brother, and of course that's the word amit. We use today as like a colleague. It can be a rough synonym of rea, your neighbor, although it's more rare in the Bible. I think I did a search on it. Where did I do one? I think it was about 10 times only.
I've got not oppressed one another.
Interesting. Amit is the word. Ein mem yutav. Amit is a friend, presumably a friend from your community. This is a brother Israelite. And as would a rea be. So it lends an interesting background to the disciples' question of Jesus, who is my, whether they said rea or amit, who is my neighbor? Because how you interpret that will influence your actions. So Leviticus is trying to say, don't oppress, or don't do a business deal that wrongs your fellow Israelite, basically, your friend, your brother. And you need to remember to do all of these things fairly, because you must fear the Lord. Like, even if you can get away with it, because if someone's desperate and they're selling their land to you, it means they have nothing. They're basically bankrupt. And they're at your mercy. So you could then set a price whatever you want to, in a sense. But you're not allowed to here, because you have to fear the Lord. And look at verse 18. I want to point this out. You must obey my statutes and my regulations. You must be sure to keep them, so that you
will dwell in the land in safety.
Or securely. Laveta. So dwelling in the land securely is kind of contingent on obeying God's statutes and regulations. And the next verse too is interesting. And the land will give you its fruit, and you may eat until you are satisfied. And he uses the same form, my translation doesn't give it, so that you will live securely in the land. So if you remember the original deal, the earth is going to produce enough for them when they're following the laws. If they're not, and the earth starts drying up and not producing the thing, that leaves them vulnerable. Like Naomi, she left the land because there was a famine. And so, in order to live securely, you need to follow the laws, because there's going to be growth given by God. And you have to treat your neighbor well. So it's kind of both things together will allow you to live securely in the land. And then it goes into the whole verse 20 to 23 about, well, how is this practically going to work? Because not only is the Jubilee the 50th year, right? So there's seven sevens. What do we call each little seven that fits inside the Jubilee? The year of
Shemitah.
What is Shemitah anyway in English?
Release.
Release? There are like these mini jubilees within the jubilee. So every 7 years,
to let it go.
You let the land go. You're not giving it back to its owner, but you're letting the land rest. And so what do you do if you let the land rest and you don't harvest? What are you going to eat? Not only for that year, but the year after, because you have to wait, you have to plant and then wait for the end of that harvest. So really, there's going to be 3 years. The year before, where you eat that harvest. The year you don't plant, you have to eat something. And then the following year until the next harvest. And so Leviticus wants to tell you, don't worry about it. I will command my blessing. So God's going to command his blessing to come down on the sixth year, that it may yield the produce for 3 years. This kind of reminds me of the blessing when the manna comes on Friday. You're going to get a double portion that's going to cover the Shabbat.
You'll get a miraculous bumper crop.
Exactly. So the system actually writes in a miraculous production on certain years. It's quite impressive. I mean, you see, the system is built to be completely dependent on God, basically. And you may sow the eighth year and eat from the 6 years produce, old produce. Until you bring in the 9th year's produce, you may eat old produce. So, first, look again at verse 23. The land must not be sold without reclaim. And that word is...
I've got permanently.
Smitut. Va'aretz lo timacher litzmitut. The land cannot be sold permanently. Why not? Ki li ha'aretz. I really like that. God's saying, because it's mine. You guys, all of Israel, you're just renters anyway. And he uses the word gerim, foreigners, like permanent residents, and toshavim, residents. You are with me. So he's saying basically, the land is mine. I've kind of given it to you as a possession. And the reason you can't sell it to other people, because it's not even yours. It's really mine. So don't sell it. Or so don't sell it permanently.
There's gerim in the land. But even you...
are gerim.
Jews are gerim.
Yeah, in my perspective, you guys are gerim. Like, you're renters. Or you're permanent residents in my land. So don't think you can just sell it away, because it's mine. I kind of like that perspective. You could even think about that today.
Absolutely.
It's still God's land. And he can rent to who he wants to rent. And that's why no sale is permanent, basically. It all goes back to who God gave it to originally. And I think that concept comes several times in our selection. Okay, so now let's go to Isaiah 24.
I was just going to say that the next bit, verse 25 onwards, which is all the stuff that we talked about a bit, is actually separated from the whole Jubilee issue.
It's like a sub-law.
If somebody becomes poor and blah, 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 then you have to redeeming relative things, which we talked about before. We said, Ruth doesn't talk about the Jubilee, but it doesn't here either.
This is like, anytime you try to practice a law, all of a sudden you realize, oh, what do we do in this case? So this is pointing out explicitly in the case of the Levites, or in the case of, a house in a walled city, that doesn't count as land. Land is outside the city. And all of that is land, and so all the years of Jubilee apply. Inside a city, it's somehow city. It's not land. And so any of your sales can be permanent. So in a sense, it's an exception to this general rule.
Yeah, all I was simply saying is, we said a few minutes ago, in the Ruth story, there's no connection with Jubilee, and in a way here, all this sort of somebody becomes poor, what do you do in a walled city, what do you do outside, what do the Levites do, etc., etc. It's all exceptions to the rule, which are not connected with Jubilee particularly.
Right. They're connected more to the Goel, the Geulah.
Yeah.
So there's Jubilee and there's redemption. So there's a tie conceptually between Jubilee and redemption.
Oh,
but then this exception to the rule is elaborating on the concept of redemption.
Right.
So it's like one step away from Jubilee. And if you notice, the rite of redemption in a city, you have 1 year. So it doesn't matter when the Jubilee is. You just get 1 year. If you can't get it back within that year, it's gone. So it's a little quicker of a business. And then it goes into the Levites. And so then that's another exception. So you see, we go from exception to exception. Because a Levite's house, because they don't have land, their house is as if it were land. So the Jubilee rite pertains to the Levitical house and not to other people's houses. So there's yet another exception in there. But it's all dealing with what should be redeemed, what has the right of redemption. And so redemption is a huge theme. Let's see, how many times can you count in this short passage here that you have the word some word of Ga'al or Ge'ula. You can count it. I think the first time is in verse 29. No, 25. Sorry, 26. 25, actually even 24.
I've got 24.
No, 24 is the first time.
Again in 25.
Again in 25. Mm-hmm.
Ga'al.
Several. You have a Go'el and a Ga'al in 25, so that's 3. Go'el 26 and Ge'ula. So I'm up to 5. Verse 27.
Twice in 26. Ga'al. Yep.
And then again 29, we're up to 6. 7, 8, and verse 30. Nine, 10, 11. So why am I counting all this stuff? Basically 11 times. 11 times in how many verses? 20? Pretty high cluster of this word. So when you're listening to this passage, the theme of redemption is very strong in your ears. And the theme of selling, right? What do you do in sales? You have ki yimko, bet moshav, you know, what do you do when someone wants to sell? So you have selling and you have redemption as big themes in Leviticus 25. So now let's go to Isaiah 24, verse 2.
What's the word for selling?
Mocher. If you want an equivalent to Ga'al, it's Mem Kafresh, Machav. That's a past tense, yeah. Okay. So, who wants to read the first 4 verses? Isaiah 24, 2 to 4. Do you want to, Sheila? Go ahead.
And it shall be as with the people, so with the priest, as with the slave, so with his master, as with the maid, so with her mistress, as with the buyer, so with the seller, as with the lender, so with the borrower, as with the creditor, so with the debtor. The earth shall be utterly laid waste and utterly despoiled, for the Lord has spoken this word.
Okay, so pause there a second. This is considered a mini apocalypse in Isaiah. You see, all the social order is kind of turned on its head, right? The seller and the buyer, it doesn't matter what your social status was, there is like this devastation that's going to come on everyone. But you have specific mention, the seller there, that's the mocher. Ka kone, ka mocher. So the one buying is going to be like the one selling. So in the normal society, the one selling might be the one that's destitute. They're going bankrupt. The one has to buy it from him. And in this apocalyptic scenario, it doesn't matter because the earth is going to waste, you know? And so all the society hierarchy has just been leveled. It would be like if there's such a crash that your money was worthless. All of a sudden, everyone who's used to being rich is just the same as anyone else who has been poor because, you know, everything's just destroyed. Okay, so let's read verse 4 to, 4 to 6. Somebody? Nicole?
The earth dries up and withers. The world languishes and withers. The exalted of the earth languish. The earth is defiled by its people. They have disobeyed the laws, violated the statutes, and broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore, a curse consumes the earth. Its people must bear their guilt. Therefore, earth's inhabitants are burned up, and very few are left.
Mm-hmm. So, a continuation of this picture. But we've switched, if you've noticed, from the people to the land itself. And kind of, this is very poetic, right? Hibok tibok ha'aretz, v'hiboz tiboz. Then you have in verse 4, avla navla ha'aretz, umlela navla tevel, umlalu merom am ha'aretz. So all these people are just mourning and completely miserable, languishing, destitute. And
verse 5.
Verse 5. What is the reason given in verse 5?
Because they've transgressed the laws, changed the ordinance, and broken the everlasting covenant. It's three.
Okay. There are three kind of parallels.
Wow.
And so the earth is polluted. Uses the word chaneh. Chanfa ha'aretz. So according to the covenant God made with the people, what happens if the people break the covenant? What happens?
Devastation.
Well, there's a whole list of things. If you read the book of Deuteronomy, it's written up like a treaty. And at the end of the treaty, there's a whole bunch of blessings and curses. You keep these laws, you're going to get a blessing. You break these laws, there's going to be some curses, which essentially are very bad consequences of breaking those laws.
Does the land expulse the people, or is it God?
It's a good question. The way it's written up, it sounds like the land can only take so much. It reaches this pollution morally and ceremonially. There's a certain limit of pollution, and then it's just going to throw you up because it can't take anymore. How that happens is kind of like a metaphor, so you don't know. Is it going to be God's going to bring an army that's going to send you into exile? Is it going to be there's a drought? Is it going to be something else? Well, that's what we're going to get to in a second then. But they broke the eternal covenant. That's the bottom line here in verse 5. And that's what's causing the destruction of the earth and the pollution of the earth. And in verse 6, Al ken ala achla eretz. The ala is this oath. It's an oath curse. So it's the same word used at the end of the book of Deuteronomy that, you know, if you don't follow these laws, these curses are going to follow you. And so almost it's a personification, as it were, of these curses. They're going to come eat up the land. And so all the people in it and all the people in it are guilty. That's interesting.
I didn't hear what Mug said, but were you asking, is it the judgment that's going to come? You answered it, Sharon, just now.
What
you
did
don't
I answer?
Know, but what I was going to...
No, how it happens. This is just basically always the case.
I just wanted to say what I really liked was this idea that of almost of vomiting out. You get it somewhere in scripture.
Yes,
I can't
you
remember
do.
Where.
Yeah.
That suddenly enough is enough.
Yeah.
And you don't know if it's a judgment that comes from above, so to speak, or whether it's an outcome. You put it simple level. If you sleep around and you get syphilis or HIV or something, is that a judgment from God that you get this terrible disease, or is it simply a consequence of the way you've been behaving?
Right.
And I think it's the same with these massive judgments, curses, whatever.
Well, these particular ones are not universal. They are specifically the covenant God has made with the people that they both agreed to. These are going to be the consequences. If you disregard my covenant, this is what's going to happen to you.
Right.
And they say, yep, we'll do it. We'll obey. They made a covenant at Sinai. And so, you know, so then if something happens, they can say, okay, yeah, well, we did agree to that. They were forewarned. However, bearing that in mind is actually surprising how gracious God can be.
Mm.
That's the huge wonder. But to continue this picture of devastation, look at verse 7. Aval tirosh. So the new wine is mourning. It's weeping. Umlela gafen. The vine is languishing. And then all the people who are happy-hearted are now sighing. And this is like stressful, distressed, kind of, that kind of thing. And then misos tupin, a joyful drumbeat has ceased. And kind of the noise of joyful people has ceased. They're using shavat there. It's quit. Misos kino, and the joy of kino, the violin. So it's really going through a picture of a feast where normally you have people celebrating, you have drinking wine, everybody's happy, and then all of a sudden you see this picture of a feast and instead everybody's mourning. Even the wine itself is mourning, and the grapevine is mourning, and everybody's sad, and there's no more playing. Almost like the violin playing stops in the middle. Bashir lo yishu yain. So with the song, they're not going to drink wine, and even the beer is going to be bitter to the drinkers. So it's like in the middle of this feast, it's all of a sudden rotten. Nothing's good.
Party's over.
Mm-hmm, party's over. And everything's going to be shut up and broken. Okay. And then at the very end, it's interesting, in verse 11, what do you have here? They howl in the streets because of what happened to the wine. I think that's hilarious. Baha al hayayin bachutzot. So everyone is crying out in the streets because all of a sudden there's no more wine, I guess. That's the problem.
But it's also very symbolic, isn't it?
It is very. Wine is a symbol of blessing and joy. It's a symbol of celebration and of
life,
yeah. And so all of a sudden, howling over no wine basically means good life has been cut off. And happiness.
The expectation of it, right? So when you're scraping along, having your bread and quail, or whatever, that's one thing. But if you're having a party and now you've just taken away all of it, then there's this horrible disappointment.
Yeah.
Causing howling.
And it even uses the word exiled. Joy. The joy of the land has been exiled, or has gone into exile.
Well, I've got darkened.
Well, before, the darkened is the arva kol simcha.
Yeah.
So there's two words for joy here. There's simcha, which is like happiness, joy, and there's mesos, or masos, if you don't have any contrast.
I've got mesos.
And that's joy, like sos asis badunai, rejoice in the Lord. So there's several words in Hebrew for joy, and of course this is poetry, so you're getting two synonyms. So one joy is going to get darkened or turn to evening, and then the other joy of the land is going to go into exile. I have disappear in my English translation. So it's interesting that it's not actually the people here that are disappearing, but it's the joy. So it's almost like a little bit of a twist on the command, but it's very ominous because you're thinking. When you use the word exile, you're thinking of exile. So what do you think connected Isaiah 24 to our original section here? What are some words that connect, and what are some themes that connect?
Well, right at the beginning was this the whole sort of upside down thing.
Mm-hmm. So there's specific reference to the buyer and the seller.
Yeah.
And how, in contrast to the normal order that we read about in Leviticus 25, now everyone's being leveled because of this kind of apocalyptic picture of normal life as you know it just being leveled. And then you move from the people to what?
To Eretz.
To the Eretz, to the land. And that's also a similar theme from Leviticus 25 because it's all about the land. What's going to happen to the land as a result of how the people behave.
Mm-hmm.
And so here you have a lot of land metaphors, the earth drying up itself, and then the produce of the land, the grapes, which of course are wine, the wine. The vine, fruit of the vine is wine. The new wine and the vine and the regular wine. It's all going. So even the concept of the joy being exiled, I think, would line up with Leviticus 25, where you have the sense of if you break the covenant, it may lead to exile, may lead to expulsion, or some other such bad consequence. So let's also look really quickly at Isaiah 52:3, because we're going to have another connection here. For this is what the Lord says: you were sold for nothing. Chinam nimkavten. And for not, wait, and you will not be redeemed for money. Velo bechesed tigaelu. For this is what the Sovereign Lord says: in the beginning my people went to live temporarily in Egypt. Assyria oppressed them for no good reason. So here we have in verse 4 mention of the two big superpowers, Egypt and Assyria. And they're kind of, sometimes they come in poetry together. Even though practically you're either going to be in one or the other, because they're opposite poles of the Middle Eastern world at that time. Okay.
And you've also got the Goel here.
You've got the Goel here. That God... So you were sold for free. That's an interesting phrase, right? You were sold for free.
But is it sold for three? I've got redeemed without money.
Both. What does it say?
Oh, yeah. Make a problem. Sold for yourself.
You were sold for nothing.
And you're redeemed without money.
Yeah. So if you were sold for nothing, you're going to be redeemed for nothing, or not with money. So that's an interesting metaphor there. And then, you know, the reference to Israel going down to live, Lagur, in Egypt. And Assyria for nothing oppressed him. And that for nothing is Be'ephes, not Bechinam, a different synonym.
Can you take that verse 3 and talk about one's relationship with God now? We've sold ourselves.
Well, let's keep reading the rest first.
We're allowed to do that?
And yeah. Now, what do we have here, says the Lord? Indeed, my people have been carried away for nothing. Those who rule over them taunt, says the Lord. There's some difficult wording here, but basically, indeed my people have been carried away for nothing. Those who rule over them taunt. It's Me'alel, and my name is constantly slandered all day long. God's name is despised because the people carry his name, right? So if they are being abused or slaves, it looks bad for God's name. And then in verse 6, for this reason my people will know my name, for this reason they will know at that time that I'm the one who says, here I am. And it goes into how delightful it is to see approaching over the mountains the feet of a messenger who announces peace, a messenger who brings good news, who announces deliverance. And there is Yeshua, who says to Zion, your God reigns. Listen, your watchmen shout. In unison they shout for joy, for they see with their very own eyes the Lord's return to Zion. In unison give a joyful shout, O ruins of Jerusalem, for the Lord consoles his people. He protects Jerusalem. Okay, where's my word? Ga'al Yerushalayim. Okay, so there's, my translation says protect. This is redeem. This is this thing that your relative does for you. The Lord reveals his royal power in the sight of all the nations. The entire earth sees our God's deliverer. Okay. Leave, get out of there. Don't touch anything unclean. Get out of it. Stay pure. You who carry the Lord's holy items, yet do not depart quickly or leave in a panic, for the Lord goes before you. The God of Israel is your rear guard. Okay. I don't see what the word I was looking for before. Anyway, okay, so basically, this is a picture of what?
Redemption.
Redemption.
And joy.
And joy, and the return of joy, you would say. Redemption, and God is the Redeemer. He is the Goel for Israel. So when something happens wrong to Israel, the ultimate relative that's going to bring justice is God.
So we see this redemption in the same way that we saw the redemption that we're talking about with Ruth?
Yes.
And God redeems, so God is redeeming back the very land here back to his people.
The land, yeah, the land for the people.
I've never really thought about that before. You think of redemption in terms of salvation most times. But
right.
If you think about this land and well, what's this here and what's going on, to think of it in terms of redemption of land is very interesting.
Yeah. The other thing, how did we not get to it? Somehow, don't remember where I got there. But in one of the passages I was reading, it's talking about the Levites or the Israelites being gods because they can't be sold as slaves because they are God's slaves. So it's the same concept of the land can't be sold to other people because it's really God's land.
So God returns those people and doesn't.
So really God owns the people and he owns the land. And so, you know, he can redeem because essentially, they're his.
I think it's the last verse of Leviticus 25.
25. Okay, let's look there.
The Israelites belong to me as servants. They are my servants.
There you go. That's what. Thank you.
Where were you?
25. Leviticus 25.
Oh, Leviticus.
Last couple of verses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What I see written all over what you're talking about is liberty and freedom, and God wants us to live in freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Christ came to set us free, so that we're not enslaved to any of the world's system.
Mm-hmm.
And he redeemed us.
He redeemed
without
us.
Right.
Yeah.
And the concept of redemption goes back to this whole system. And the Israelites being God's chosen possession, they are his servants, his avadim, you could say his slaves. So if they've been sold to Egypt temporarily as slaves to Egypt, they're going to be redeemed at some point because they really still belong to God. And so he is the one who brought them up out of Egypt to get back his own people. So I like some of these themes as they all switch together in your mind. You have this image of like God's perspective. And I kind of like it because everything else seems more trivial. You have to be just in your dealings, your economic dealings with each other. But the reason is because anyway, you're all just God's servants and it's really just his land. And so... You know, don't get too...
There's no money.
Yeah.
No money.
Don't get too carried away with your own selfish ambitions because all of that is secondary. It's like a parent, you know, two kids are fighting over toys. It's like the parent is the one that bought that toy and gave it to the kid. And so in the end, it's the parent's toy. And the parent can say, okay, you know, you take it now. And then after 5 minutes, you can share it with your brother or sister. But just remember, you're really just under my house because everything's really the parents. Yeah.
So is that why the state of Israel owns most of the land? Because it's acting like God. Yoni was saying
this. Because it specifically says the land can't be sold for smitut, for a permanent sale because
so
it's really good.
So settlements are 49-year leases, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, really a lot of the land in this country are, or 99-year leases.
Right.
Or, yeah.
They did change something in that though recently, and I don't know exactly.
Yeah, they probably have. But there is, the concepts are based on some of these biblical concepts.
Yeah,
however, they've been changed or adapted today. I'm not a specialist in modern property sales.
Was that God's intention that the state would act? I mean, or like the government, the king, whatever, would act on his behalf in terms of the ownership?
It's an interesting question. When the Israelites were first given the land, there was no king.
Right.
There was no direct system of government. So everything would have to be worked out as that develops.
So you get to a certain tribe, and then you drew lots for your particular section.
Sure. And then you had a whole tribe moving, right? The tribe of Dan just got up and left their original place and went up north.
Because of the snakes.
Right.
Because of the snakes? I don't know. What's your comment there?
Because of the field for the cow.
And then you have...
No.
You have those Philistine problems. But then you have, in a modern case, we have the example of Hong Kong. So in Hong Kong, they made a lease for, I believe it was 99 years.
Yeah.
Someone can correct me. And
then it reverts back to China.
And then it was, of course, supposed to be renegotiated. And 100 years is a long time. So in this case, whole theories of ownership change.
Yeah.
The theory of what it is to own property, the theory of what it is to have a government, the theory of what it is for people to participate in a government, all of that totally changed during that 100 years. And so they had to renegotiate it, but it was not the same world at all over such a period. And the world and the culture in this world is changing so rapidly that these time figures are very difficult for us to relate to. If you think of culture in the United States in the 1950s, and 50 years later in this millennium, the culture, the norms, what they consider right and wrong are almost upside down different. And this is the world we're living in is going through faster changes in these years than in antiquity. In antiquity, the technological infrastructure changed.
Yeah, it had a different graph. It was more linear graph.
Very slowly. Mm-hmm. So 100 years later, technologically, it was the same culture. And so they're having to do the same things. They're having to get up and milk the cows just like they did 100 years earlier. They don't all of a sudden have mechanization and cities and whatever. So,
and so your point is that...
The point is that these... As we discuss these years, and as we look even at something like Israel, and as it tries to base its years on biblical terms, all of this is going to be very problematic, especially in a time of very rapid change, and you start talking about 50 and 100-year-long periods, when the cultural equivalent now is probably 5-year periods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, well, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.